From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a cliche, but it's true. Elizabeth Vargas really did have it all, or so it seemed. ABC News anchor and correspondent covering the biggest stories of the day, and a married mother of two. On the inside, it was a different picture. An alcoholic, torn up by anxiety, falling apart. This hour on Point, a sobering conversation about addiction, alcoholism, and hope with Elizabeth Vargas. You can join us on air or online. Is the fight with alcohol something you know about? Could this be your story? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York City is Elizabeth Vargas, co-anchor of ABC's 2020, and my former colleague, I should add. In her long career, she's anchored World News Tonight, co-hosted Good Morning America, as well as Dateline NBC, and today, her new book is called Between Breaths, A Memoir of Panic and Addiction. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Elizabeth Vargas, thanks for being here. Nice to have you.
Nice to be with you, Jane. Great to talk to you again.
Well, thank you. You're so authentic in this book. It's such an important topic. Help us understand how a woman at the very top of her profession, so poised, polished, smart, can manage and even conceal such a debilitating problem as alcoholism.
Well, the alcoholism was something I was concealing really probably just for the last 7 years. What I did spend my whole life and my whole career concealing was my terrible anxiety. I've had it since I was a child. My earliest memories are infused with anxiety and fear. When I was 6 years old, my dad went to Vietnam, and I began having panic attacks literally every single day. And we're talking full out crying, begging, screaming, you know, clinging to my mother, begging her not to leave me every single morning that she went to work that year that my dad was at war. And, you know, at that time, Jane, they weren't helping Vietnam vets who were coming back from the war with all sorts of serious issues. They certainly weren't helping the children of those vets. So I learned what proved to be a pretty destructive lesson that year, which was to keep my anxiety hidden. And I did so for my entire life, you know, keeping that all deep inside and pretending not to feel the fear and the anxiousness and the insecurity and the worry that I was actually racked with every single day.
And so what was then the connection between that anxiety and ultimately the alcoholism?
Well, we've learned in all the investigating that I've done on this story that women in general are much more likely than men to self-medicate, whether it's over anxiety or depression or stress. We're much more likely to turn to something, and that's what I began doing. I didn't drink as a teenager, barely in high school and not at all in college. I really started having a few glasses of wine, a glass or two of wine at night after work when I was starting out in local news in my 20s. And everybody would go to the, you know, local bar after the local newscast at 6 or 7 and have a few drinks. And I thought, wow, that works. That helps take that edge off that anxiety. And as I write in my book, everybody seemed smarter and prettier and more interesting, even me. You know, my insecurities started to fade a little bit. So initially for me, for quite a long time, alcohol worked. But what happens, and I've talked to other women who are alcoholics who drank to soften or numb their depression, and the same thing for them. What it works initially, and then it doesn't. It boomerangs. It comes back. And I found out later when talking to doctors that actually drinking like that begins to, far from numbing or soothing the anxiety, it begins to fuel the anxiety.
Mm. Mm. There's a scene in the beginning of the book describing what it's like to go live on a national network news broadcast and how underneath the poise and the polish you are racked by anxiety. Could you read that passage, Elizabeth?
Sure. I take another tiny sip of water and another deep breath. 10, 9, 8. Damn it, I wish you wouldn't count down like that. 2, 1, and we're on the air. The show's opener rolls. This is World News Tonight, reported by Elizabeth Vargas. I draw in a deep breath, grip the desk hard with my right hand, and press the sharp edge of my engagement ring into my left thumb. I need these physical reminders to stay focused, to stop worrying that I might vomit on live television or have a panic attack and hyperventilate. I then look directly into the camera and say, "Good evening, we begin tonight." And 30 minutes later, it is done. Afterward, we all troop downstairs to the newsroom, and there we sit at desks in a circle and discuss what worked with the newscast, what didn't, what the competition led with, and how the order of our stories compared. There is always, for me, a certain giddiness when it's over, a sense of being wrung out from the effort it takes not just to manage my anxiety, but to conceal it. And then an overwhelming feeling. Dear God, I need a drink. And Jane, I think that that shows not only sort of the anxiety I would feel as the stage manager counted down to the beginning of the newscast, and I have since found out that Diane Sawyer and David Muir also hated that, that it really does make you feel anxious, but how my first thought was, okay, a glass of wine right now would make this better.
Well, you write about leading a double life of sorts. Did anyone ever call you out on your drinking? Family, husband, a coworker? Were they afraid to call you out because of who you were?
The only person who knew about my drinking was my husband. He didn't approach it in the right way because he didn't know any better. But he, sort of said angrily, "You drink too much, you know." And at that point, this was when we were dating. We weren't even married yet. And I was drinking like all of my friends, so I didn't understand what he meant. And it really made me angry. I did cut back, though, at that point. I thought, I should cut back. I'll cut back. And I did. And I got married, and I had two beautiful, healthy, amazing children. And it was only after the birth of my second child that I thought I had postpartum depression. Something wasn't right. I was crying all the time. I couldn't sleep. I knew I had only 11 weeks of paid leave before I had to go back to work. And I was the breadwinner of our family. So there was a huge amount of stress. And I was going back to work after getting what I felt like was a very humiliating demotion. I had been removed from the evening news anchor desk and right before I went on maternity leave. And sort of all my lifelong anxiety was now really big. I kept going to all these doctors to say, "I've got postpartum depression. Something's wrong." And they kept examining me and saying, "No, you don't have postpartum depression. You're just anxious." And I was like, "This isn't right. I've had anxiety my whole life. This feels different." Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it was the hormones postpartum. A lot of doctors say that women either postpartum or perimenopausal can make things very dire for you, and you can feel very blue and very, very, if you're prone to depression, more depressed, or prone to anxiety, more anxious. So, you put into that big stew of my anxiety, postpartum, dealing with all of that, the hormonal issues, enormous stress of supporting my entire family all by myself. And I think my marriage was in a rough spot at that point. I felt very alone. And I began to drink. And that's when my drinking began to take off into something more destructive. I managed to keep it a secret, from colleagues and from the rest of my family.
Well, in fact, you write, "The more I chased the glow, the more elusive it became. Determined to rediscover it, I would drink more. The hangover morphed from bleary, shaky mornings to entire days when I counted the hours until I could go home and have another drink."
Yeah.
So your first trip to rehab, you write that you dipped your toe into recovery when you sort of knew you had a problem. But tell us your attitude going into that. When did you realize, I have to do something here?
Well, I first dipped my toe, and that is an apt, very nice way of describing it. I somehow convinced this lovely place that I could only come for 2 weeks because I couldn't tell my bosses, what I was doing. Part of the reason I wrote this book, Jane, is to reduce some of the stigma and shame about this. I felt so much shame that I felt like I could not tell my bosses that I would be fired, that I would be judged harshly, that my career would be over. So I really kept it a secret. And I went for 2 weeks. And, of course, that's ridiculous. And ended up going back to that place a few months later after what is undoubtedly my most frightening episode of drinking. And then I stayed for a full month. And it was an amazing place, you know, and it helped me a lot. And I stayed sober for a good 6 to 7 months after coming home from that. But I was in still a lot of denial, and I didn't do everything when I got home that they told me I should do to maintain my sobriety. I just thought, okay, did that, done, now I'm all better. And, you know, when life throws you a curveball, you're not prepared. And I wasn't. It's been interesting. In talking to the NIAA, the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse, they gave me some astonishing statistics that showed that 62% of women who are alcoholics also suffer from anxiety. The link between, in women especially, because it's only 35% in men, the link between anxiety and alcoholism in women is enormous. And you're a living, walking, breathing example of it. But the other statistic they had is that if you are anxious, you are twice as likely to relapse. And that's the other thing that I hope to, speak about, because I know that there are a lot of people out there who don't understand why alcoholics relapse or addicts relapse. And the fact of the matter is most addicts relapse on average 3 to 7 times, according to these same statistics, before they finally get sober. I've told friends of mine that when I go meet with other alcoholics, the unicorn in the room is the person who got sober the very first time they tried.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. My guest today is Elizabeth Vargas, co-host of ABC's 2020. Her new book is called Between Breaths, a memoir of panic and addiction. You can join the conversation. When does social drinking turn into something more destructive? Have you fought this battle? Do you think women and men face a different battle with alcohol, and why? Here is Elizabeth Vargas on the set of ABC News World News tonight, taking up the baton from Peter Jennings during the network's coverage of the 9/11 attack.
So Elizabeth Vargas is going to take over the anchor chair here for a spell. Thank you, Elizabeth, very much.
This is, as Peter just said, ABC News continuing coverage of that terrorist attack on the United States. I am Elizabeth Vargas, and the grim task of searching for victims of the attack on New York's World Trade Center is continuing around the clock.
Elizabeth, you describe in the book your first bout of binge drinking, which was a couple of years before that, in 2009. Tell us about that. You were in bad shape. You were finding yourself reaching for a bottle of wine. Tell us about that. Set it up and then read the passage from your book.
Right. That was after 9/11.
Ah, okay.
8 years after 9/11. And it was in 2009, in obviously November. I remember I had been home alone with the kids, and we needed a babysitter to come over, and they the night before didn't come and sort of sent an email saying, I've decided to be a governess instead of a nanny, so I won't be working for your family, and good luck. And I was like, wait a minute, I have to go to work in 8 hours. And So I, in anger and in frustration and scrambling to find childcare, I began pouring myself many glasses of wine. Here's the passage. When Mark came home the following day in the morning, I was still in bed, and he could see that I was very sick from all the alcohol. I went to my doctor, who promptly admitted me into the hospital. I spent a day and 2 nights that Thanksgiving week in a private room under a pseudonym, getting IV rehydration and Ativan. Once the wine wore off, I was shocked and horrified at what I had done. When the nurse came in to check my vital signs, I could barely make eye contact. Mark came to visit with the boys, who only knew that Mommy was sick. I had failed at the most sacred task assigned me, being a good mother. You would have thought that enormous guilt and shame would have led me to swear off alcohol forever. You would be wrong.
And so are you telling yourself at this point, well, sometimes I drink too much, but I'm not an alcoholic?
Absolutely. I mean, denial is an enormous part of my story, and probably part of a lot of addict stories. That's how we get into such trouble. We miss those early warning signs that we're doing something in an unhealthy way. And I kept thinking, I'm so and even my husband would tell me this, and eventually my sister, who was the other person I finally confided in. I was so disciplined, Jane, in every other aspect of my life. And yet in this one aspect, it was completely a mess. And I couldn't understand that. I kept telling myself, you know, you're drinking because you're anxious and you're stressed and you're overwhelmed. You've got to get this under control. And I would berate myself, like, come on, get it together. Not recognizing that this is a disease, and telling an alcoholic to stop drinking is like telling someone with depression to be happy. You don't just, you know, flip a switch and exert some self-control and do it. You have to seek medical help.
You're so honest in this book, and so many listeners are writing in here to thank you for that. I want you to read more from the book, because there's a chapter entitled Blackout, where you write about a defining moment. It was an afternoon in the summer of 2012, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're on your way to a shoot for 2020. You're in the car. You ask the driver to pull over. Set up the story, Elizabeth, and then read from the book.
That was one of, you know, that's the depths of my drinking was 2012. And at that point, you know, when you're in the cycle, it wasn't like this every night. I mean, that's part of how I was able to lead this secret life. But on some mornings, you would wake up and you would feel so horrible. I mean, Jane, I can't even describe how horrible you would feel. I couldn't go to the gym and work it off, which is what I did many days. I couldn't, you know, sleep in that morning because I had to work. Rehydrating with some Gatorade mm-hmm. wasn't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're that hungover, at that point, you feel like the only thing that will make you feel better is a little bit more alcohol to steady yourself. And that's when you're in the death spin. I mean, that's really the final throes of the disease. At least it was for me. And on this day, I was on my way to a shoot and feeling like this, and had the taxi cab driver pull over so that I could, you know, ostensibly to go into the pharmacy, but instead I went into the wine store right next door and bought a bottle of wine and stuck it in my purse. And when the shoot was over, began drinking it, and cut to this scene in the book. Late afternoon, Friday, a woman driving down Riverside Drive spots me someplace along the park. She pulls over and offers me a ride home. I am able to tell her where I live. By the time she arrives at my apartment building, I am unconscious. A superintendent carries me into the lobby while the frantic doorman calls Mark. The woman tells Mark she picked me up because she saw two sketchy-looking men hanging around me nearby. Mark waits for an ambulance with me, watching me breathe, terrified that at any moment my breath will cease. I still have no idea how much wine I drank that day, nor do I have any idea where I went when I finished that shoot, nor what I did. All I know is how lucky I am for what didn't happen that day. I wasn't robbed or raped in the park while unable to defend myself, and because that woman brought me home, I didn't die from alcohol poisoning. For the first time, I was truly terrified. I needed help.
And you remember nothing. You remember
nothing
about those 13 hours.
Nothing. There are many, many people, not even alcoholics, you know, who have had blackouts while drinking. And I never have in my whole life. This is the only one I've had. I've always been able – I've had what I call brownouts, where I might not remember some details of the night before, but I'm always able to piece it together. And I cannot pry any memory out of 8 hours of that day. My next memory after leaving the shoot and putting my seatbelt on in the car to drive away is my next memory is waking up in the emergency room at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Elizabeth, I want to bring Catherine McHugh into this conversation. She's a psychologist with the Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse at McLean Hospital and professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School here in Boston. Her clinical work and research focuses on gender differences and the intersection of anxiety and substance abuse. She's with me in the studio. Catherine, great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Does Elizabeth's story sound familiar to you?
Absolutely. It's been very striking hearing her story. Even hearing her say at some point, wow, this works. You know, for someone who's been dealing with anxiety since a very young age, one of the challenges is that alcohol does work, and it works quite well in the short term. The problem is that in the long term, it's also what we call anxiogenic, which means that it also can create anxiety over time and exacerbate anxiety. And you see sort of this almost chasing your tail of you feel more anxious and you drink, and you feel less anxious and you feel more anxious, you drink again. And people have a very hard time breaking out of that.
So what's the difference between a heavy drinker and an alcoholic? When is it defined as a problem?
This is a complicated question in some ways, because really you have to think of this along a continuum. You're ranging from people who don't drink at all to people who may be able to drink in safety to people who drink perhaps at a level that could cause health problems. It really, one of the keys to when this shifts to becoming a problem is when you start to face some kind of consequences, when it starts to impact your life, your ability to go to work, care for your children, it starts to impact your health, your mental health. And a real hallmark of alcohol use disorder is a loss of control over your drinking.
Elizabeth, the consequences in your life were significant.
Sure. I mean, I would be naive to think I haven't, suffered work consequences, even though I still have a wonderful job today. I did almost lose this job that, you know, I love what I do for a living. It has been a passion of mine. I've been doing it since I graduated from college, and I love it. And I nearly lost it. My marriage crumbled as a result of my drinking. I nearly lost my children. And that episode that I just read a passage of my book from, you know, the level of alcohol I had in my blood at the hospital that day was lethal. If that woman hadn't come along and taken me home, I don't know that I would have survived. So I nearly lost my life.
What are the trends, Catherine, in drinking in women versus men?
Sure. If you look back 30 years ago, this was an illness that predominantly affected men. 30 years ago, it was 5-1 men to women struggling with this illness. And both in the U.S. and internationally, you're starting to see that gap being bridged. Now, the male-to-female ratio is closer to 2-1. And if you look in adolescents and teens, it's actually closer to 1-1. So this is increasingly an issue for women, and one that often goes unrecognized or under-recognized, which is why when Elizabeth sharing her story so bravely is really important, I think, for the recognition of this illness in women.
What are the reasons that those numbers are changing?
You know, there are a number of things that can be contributing to that. One thing that we know about what will cause people to start drinking is how accessible it is and what the perceptions are of risk. So how risky someone perceives a substance to be is a huge predictor of whether or not they'll initiate. So once you start to see alcohol being perceived as something that's not that harmful, you see those rates go up and you start to see them normalize.
Women metabolize alcohol differently as well.
Correct. Yes. So alcohol is metabolized in the liver, but it's also metabolized in the stomach. And there are differences in the enzymes in the stomach between men and women in terms of how alcohol is metabolized. So typically you will see a higher concentration of alcohol in women than in men.
I've got so many listeners who want to join here. I've got to get to a couple here. Kaylee in Somerville, Massachusetts. I'm glad you waited, Kaylee. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Yes, go ahead.
So first of all, Elizabeth, thank you so much, for what you said. And I'm calling in as a female, who's been sober, for 4 years. So I think I definitely uniquely identify with, this program today. So I felt like calling in, and, what I wanted to touch on was, you know, just kind of the insanity of alcohol, right? So, people who aren't alcoholic, you know, it's so hard for them to understand. And I think you really touched on that. And, you know, something that really struck me, I've heard, is that somebody was talking about just like drinking, right? And an alcoholic starts drinking and then, you know, a couple drinks in, they feel in control, right? And someone who's a non-alcoholic is a couple drinks in and they're starting to feel out of control, so they stop, right? And I think the problem is it doesn't make sense, right? So if you're a real alcoholic, getting sober, you know, is hard, right? Because mm-hmm. alcohol is what kind of, you know, makes us feel okay and our skin fit, mm-hmm. you know, and all that anxiety. doesn't feel so heavy, right?
Kaylee, I thank you very much for the call, and I want to get Elizabeth in here. Elizabeth, it's two edges of a sword here, right? I mean, you go into it, and then you have to come out of it in a very different way.
Well, it's interesting what Kaylee said, because she said something very important there. When I was talking to the head researcher for NIAA, they said that people who are anxious and who drink, after a while, because of the boomerang effect and how your body is metabolizing that, she said at the end, an alcoholic will need two drinks just to feel normal, just to feel okay the way you feel, you know, day in and day out. So I'm operating, in essence, at a deficit after a certain point because of that important fact we've been discussing, that the alcohol actually fuels the anxiety. So the anxiety is now even bigger, and I have to drink even more just to feel okay, and then even more to feel better and, you know, and managing my anxiety. So it's an interesting sort of snowballing effect that you start needing to drink more and more and more, not to feel good, just to feel okay enough to operate.
Kaylee, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Sam in Staunton, Virginia. Hi, Sam. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for this program.
Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
So I've actually been 6 months clean and sober this past Monday, and I went to a rehab facility. One thing that I found with alcoholism is that all through my childhood and even in young adulthood, that anxiety and depression and self-worth were such a big problem. And I had unhealthy coping skills that I used, but alcohol was a lot easier to use than actually trying. And I ended up just chasing that numb feeling for years. Mm. And it's that numbness that, at least for me, that I sought after. Mm.
Sam, thank you very much. Elizabeth Vargas, you relate to that. I know you write about it in the book.
I do. And Sam brings up an important point, too, that I think I hope will be some, you know, some comfort to the families of addicts and alcoholics who truly suffer, which is that, you know, you should know this about somebody who's suffering and who's doing something destructive, like drinking too much or doing drugs. It's not that they want to do this. They don't want to destroy themselves, but they are in so much pain. There is something that is so painful to them, they will do anything not to feel it. It's not because they don't love their spouses or their children or their families or their lives or their jobs. It's that there is something that is so painful that they are feeling. You'll do anything not to feel it.
How do you cope now with your anxiety, Elizabeth, instead of drinking?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, especially given what your other guest has said there about her expertise on anxiety and alcoholism. I mean, my anxiety is much lower now that I stopped drinking. So it's like this incredible gift. But I meditate every day, which really helps me with the what I call the reflective pause, instead of being off like a jackrabbit and reacting to whatever scares me or stresses me or, you know, it's given me the ability to stop and catch it early and examine it and make sure, you know, is this real? What am I afraid of? What's happening to me? You know, I pray a lot, Jane. My faith has become very important to me in my recovery. I meet with other alcoholics on a regular basis, because just hearing other people talk about what they're going through is a true comfort. And that's largely what led me to write this book, because if I can get so much comfort in my meetings from hearing other people talk about their experiences, perhaps my story can offer some comfort to others out there.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about women and drinking and when it tips over to alcoholism. And you can join the conversation. What are the pressures that are driving women to drink too much? My guests are Elizabeth Vargas, co-host of ABC's 2020 and author of Between Breaths, a memoir of panic and addiction, and Catherine McHugh, a psychologist with the Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse at McLean Hospital and a professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. Here's a clip of Elizabeth following time in rehab in 2014. She sat down with ABC's George Stephanopoulos and before the nation talked honestly and courageously about her battle with addiction.
You're an alcoholic.
I am. I am an alcoholic. It took me a long time to admit that to myself. It took me a long time to admit it to my family. But I am.
What was the reaction, Elizabeth, when you admitted that?
Oh, it was wonderfully supportive. I mean, and I, you know, that's the one thing that I think that I would like to say to people out there who are wondering if they have a problem with alcohol or struggling with the fact that they know that they already do, is that I think reaching out to people and being honest about what you're struggling with can actually makes people open their arms and come to you. I spent so many years first in denial and then just so ashamed that I never reached out and I never admitted it and I never told anybody. And I cut myself off from a lot of help and a lot of support that was there once I did.
Catherine, there's a huge debate within your profession about whether it's possible to moderate drinking as opposed to stopping it altogether. Where do you follow that? How do you see it?
Sure. This comes back to the idea that, again, struggles with alcohol use fall along a continuum. And when it comes to treatment and sort of the path to recovery, there's no one size fits all. You know, in general, for people who are really struggling with severe alcohol use disorder, abstinence tends to be the safest option. Once you're pretty far down that road, being able to control drinking is quite difficult, in part, again, because really one of the hallmarks of this disorder is a loss of control over drinking.
Is it hard not to drink now, Elizabeth?
No, not as hard as you'd think it would be, given that it was my go-to soother for so many years. It's a friend of mine in recovery once told me that getting stopped is harder than staying stopped. You know, forgive the mangled grammar, but that's the way it was, and it's true. The hardest thing of all was the first few days and weeks, and even months. It gets much easier, and that's what I would tell anybody who's struggling right now, is that it does get easier, and it does get so much better.
Let's get Bridget in here from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Hi, Bridget. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jean. Elizabeth, your story resonates with me so powerfully. I was a reporter for radio, and when I saw you on television talking about your alcoholism. I've been sober for almost a decade, but when I was reporting all of the anxiety, it would hit like mid-report, and all I could think about was drinking. And you just have to be so perfect when you're on the air, and you have to be so put together and so everything, and so you just hide it. And I just thank you so much for sharing your story because I feel like you're part of my team now.
Bridget, thank you so much.
I am part of your team, Bridget, but she brings up an important thing. And Jane, I don't know, you know, you're a colleague of mine and has spent as many years in front of the camera probably as I have, but I did feel that need to be perfect. And it's impossible and unreasonable. And now that I feel and accept that it's okay to be, you know, okay, I don't have to be perfect 100% of the time, you can give yourself a little bit of a break and relieve yourself of a little bit of that stress and pressure.
Be real, right? Be
yeah,
real.
Exactly.
Let's get Melissa in here from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Melissa. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. How are you? And Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for everything you're doing to bring light to this horrible disease. I've been married to an alcoholic for 25 years. I have two college-age children. I'm a professional woman, and my life has been defined by my husband's disease outside of my professional life. And my question for you and your guest is, how does the family get help? What can we do when we are ashamed to admit that we live with this problem?
First of all, I'm so sorry that you're going through that. That must be incredibly painful for all of you. You know, there are groups out there, support groups, that you can go to that help specifically families of alcoholics and addicts. I know one of them is Al-Anon. You can go and talk with other people there. I think the other thing is just to know that you know, the alcoholic, he's not drinking because he doesn't love you. He's not drinking because of you. It's not your fault. You can't control it. He's going to have to decide he wants to stop drinking. And you need to protect yourself and take care of yourself while not – I would say the one thing is the worst thing that ever happened to me was to be shamed. And I think when people ask me, as many have, how do I talk to this person in my life who drinks too much or who has a drug problem? And I've said, you know, you need to talk to them from the heart. You know, please, I believe in you. Don't do this to yourself. You're hurting me. Please don't hurt me. But not to shame them, because that will – these people feel – addicts and alcoholics, at least I did, felt so much shame anyway that to add on and to pile on the shame, I'll just drink to not feel that.
Catherine, you know? You're nodding your head to what Elizabeth is saying.
Yes, I couldn't agree more with that point. One thing that we certainly know is that shame is not the way to – help someone. People are feeling more than enough shame already, and if that was sufficient, it would have worked long ago. And just to echo Elizabeth's point, there are a number of different resources, Al-Anon being a wonderful resource. The National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism has a lot of wonderful resources, and a number of treatment facilities. Ours at McLean Hospital offers a lot of programming for family because it impacts the entire family system, and help is really critical.
Melissa, good luck to you, and thanks so much for calling. Here's Cynthia in Charlottesville, Virginia. Cynthia, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to offer something additional to that caller. I am actually the mother of an alcoholic, and I am just realizing the enabling that I have done as a result of my own insecurities and how we have become a very unhealthy relationship. And I just wanted to share with parents that I think if you can somehow step back and remove yourself from that relationship, it stands to help both of you. Mm-hmm. We're in a very fragile place right now, the two of us. So it's going to take a lot of work on my part, as well as on his part, to be able to get beyond this. But just another insight from...
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate it very much. And I'm glad you called, Cynthia. Thank you. Let's go to Ashley in Shelbourne, Vermont. Hi, Ashley. Welcome to you.
Hi. Thank you. I am moved by this, and I do want to share. In April, I lost my alcoholic brother to suicide. I am all about erasing the stigma now to all of these illnesses. Alcoholism is an illness. Depression is an illness. But what I've since learned since April 9th, when my best friend, who was amazing in every way, my best friend, when he passed, I've now learned alcoholism is a huge comorbidity factor. I thought suicidal people had a big neon sign that said, I'm about to end my life. I've since learned the alcoholism is so much more than just alcoholism. It's very, very serious. And I think the links have to be made much more well known.
Ashley, thank you. I mean, it leads me to this question, Catherine McHugh, that I was going to ask you, the barriers to treatment. How do we get there? How do we help these people?
Sure. One thing we know is in any given year, less than 20% of women who might benefit from treatment receive treatment, which is a huge gap. And really, there are two categories of barriers, both of which actually affect women more than they do men. One is logistical barriers. So these could be things like financial ability to get to treatment, caretaking responsibilities, both child care and elder care that predominantly fall on women. What actually appears to be even more important are internal barriers. We hear Elizabeth talk a lot about the issue of shame, issues of, can I walk into a building that's a psychiatric hospital on the side? And also concerns about will treatment help in the sense that I should be able to do this on my own? And those are attitudes we really do need to change to be able to get people the help that they need. Mm.
Elizabeth, do you feel like people are watching you more closely now in a restaurant or at work? Do you feel like you're under the glare of the spotlight because of this?
No, but it's funny you ask because I do feel like, if I'm ever like sick with the flu, I know this is actually partly true, Jane, that people, because when part of the way I was able to maintain a secret life was on the days that I didn't feel like I could work because I hadn't had too much to drink the night before, I would call in sick. And so I'm very nervous for the first time I have to call in sick. Like, I'll feel like, if you want, I'll take a test or something. I swear I haven't been drinking. But no, mostly it's pretty great. I don't feel like people are watching me. I am perfectly able to be out socially with people who are drinking, and it doesn't bother me. Other people might not feel the same way. And, you know, it's important to protect yourself. If you feel like you're in an environment where it's making you uncomfortable, you should get up and leave. You know, don't put yourself in any – don't test yourself any more than you have to.
Let's go to Melissa in Clarksville, Tennessee. Melissa, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Jane. Thanks.
You bet.
For receiving my call. Hey, Elizabeth. 1,000 high fives to you, darling. I appreciate what you're doing. I feel like we're twins because I drank the same way. I drank over, in the beginning, this mad energy I had, and then it turned into panic attacks and anxiety. And then I realized that when I took a drink, how it quelled that beast. And so I would continue. And then before I knew it, you know, I had crossed that line into alcoholism and became a morning drinker, you know, showed up in rehab centers, nervous hospitals, halfway houses. And I spent 25 years in and out of a 12-step recovery program, AA, and hallelujah for AA, because eventually, 18 years later, I was able to get my first year, and now I have 8 years.
Oh, congratulations, Melissa. Ah, that's terrific. Well, I'm glad you called. I got to bring Catherine McHugh back here. Talk a little bit more about the gender differences when we're talking about alcoholism. I read somewhere you say women telescope addiction differently than men.
Sure. Well, this is what
does
we
that
call,
mean?
It's what we call the telescoping effect, which means women are actually more susceptible to a quicker escalation of the illness, where the time to first drink, to problem drinking, to severe problems is often quicker in women. The flip side to that is you can also see sort of a stair-step escalation, where someone may be okay drinking socially, some kind of stressor hits, they escalate their drinking, it plateaus, then another stressor hits. I mean, Elizabeth spoke about postpartum anxiety and stressors as a big stressor that escalated her drinking. And that's another pathway you can see.
Elizabeth, if you were prepping to do this interview, what's the one question that gets right to the heart of all this? What would it be?
Oh, my goodness. I think you've asked them all. But I mean, for me, it's just the, you know, and Catherine's talked a lot about this, the extraordinary link between anxiety and alcoholism. And I just think I know that we've been told that a lot of treatment centers are now re-examining the way they treat women with alcoholism and are also suffering from anxiety. It's really important to understand that these gender differences that Catherine's been pointing out, the telescoping thing she was just, you know, talking about, is so interesting because I recognize myself in that. I drank normally for 25 years, and then it was like I fell off a cliff. You know, and I still, you know, I once asked, you know, Earl Hightower, who's a towering figure in the world of recovery, I was like, was I born an alcoholic or did I just become an alcoholic? And he said, it doesn't matter. You are an alcoholic. We have to stop quibbling over how did I become and just deal with what is.
You write about this acronym HALT in your book, Elizabeth.
Yes.
Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. What did you learn about those feelings quickly as they relate to your alcoholism?
Well, they tell you in recovery that any of those feelings are when you're in the danger zone, that you need to – and that's part of sort of what meditation helps with, is that sort of awareness. If you're not panicky about everything, you can be a little calmer in examining yourself and watching yourself and making sure, okay, do I feel this or that? Or, you know, for me, angry is the biggest trigger for me. And somebody once told me that, you know, drinking when you're angry at somebody is like drinking poison and waiting for them to die. It's ridiculous. You're not accomplishing anything. You're just hurting yourself.
The last three lines of your book, you say, one step at a time, one day at a time, be strong, be grateful, just do the next right thing, and you will arrive. What are your final thoughts, Elizabeth Vargas, about this journey, the lessons you've learned?
That life is to be savored, and it is a huge privilege to have each and every day on this earth. I don't take a single one of them for granted. That you can spend your entire life feeling guilt and anguish over what happened, or worry and stress over what's to come, and miss what is. And that's what my drinking did to me. And in sobriety, I do everything I can to savor every moment.
Well, we appreciate your honesty and your willingness to come and speak about it. Elizabeth Vargas, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jane.
Elizabeth, co-host of ABC's 2020, she's the author of the new memoir, Between Breaths, a memoir of panic and addiction. Also, Catherine McHugh, psychologist with the Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse at McLean Hospital, professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. Appreciate your insights and all the information. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you so much, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, On Point Live from Kent State University in Ohio. Tom is there with young voters in that battleground state. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.